Hi, this is Ned Siegfried from Siegfried & Jensen. As proud sponsors of BeliefCast, we hope you are inspired by Todd's weekly podcasts, which contain so many courageous stories of recovery and personal growth. Remember, it's not what happened in the past that matters, it's what happens in the future. We invite you all to work hard and be optimistic about your future. Enjoy today's podcast.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Todd Sylvester with the Todd Inspires BeliefCast. As always, thanks for tuning in and for supporting me. Your belief in me fuels me more than you'll know, so thank you. It really has gotten me through some dark times in my life, so thank you so much. And then also a shout-out to my sponsors, Maury Nutrition, Siegfried & Jensen, Wasatch Recovery, Thread Wallets, and then the music you heard at the beginning and at the end of this podcast is by my good friend Paul Cardall. He's an award-winning pianist. He's got 25 million active listeners every month, and I can't thank him enough for being willing to let us use his music. So thank you. Today, you guys are in for a treat. We have H.R. Huntsman with us today. H.R., thanks for being with us today.
Todd, it's a pleasure. I'm honored to be here, my friend. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. Well, a little background on HR. He's an exceptional organizational strategist and an executive coach. I mean, this guy, he's climbed Kilimanjaro, Mount Rainier. He does bungee jumping. He's married to the love of his life, Gwen. He has done roughly, I think it's 3,000 speaking events to almost 500,000 people all over the world. This guy gets out of bed on fire and loves life. His motto is to enjoy, you know, look at life as a gift and enjoy it as much as he possibly can. And he's never looked back on that. And, you know, you guys are going to, you're in for a treat today. And so am I. And so HR, I know there's a lot more. We're going to just hear more from you, but thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure again. I'm happy to be here. It's going to be fun.
Yeah. So why don't we start HR about, just tell us a little bit about your childhood and maybe where you grew up and just give our listeners a little background on who you are and where you came from.
Sure. Grew up in southern New Mexico. I describe my home as pretty dysfunctional and chaotic. Quite a bit of death, alcoholism, anger. Mm-hmm. My biological father had his first stroke when I was 18 months of age, and he stayed in my house. My mom was his caretaker for the next, 7.5 years. At age 9, I found him dead in the backyard. I didn't know he was my dad at the time.
Oh, wow.
My mom, like I said, became his caretaker and actually remarried during that time while she was taking care of him. It wasn't until after he passed away that she let me know that he was actually my father. And I had two younger brothers at this time. So it was a real weird situation. Here's this guy living in my house. He couldn't remember where his bedroom was, but he taught me how to ride a bike and swing on a swing. And then I find out he was my dad, just super confusing. And
yeah.
First stepdad ran off with another woman. Second stepdad, alcoholism was always a big part of this. Men in and out of my life. Second stepdad was abusive to my mom and myself and the brothers, and another brother through him. Anyway, big hole where a healthy father should be. Didn't know who I was, my identity. I mean, just the chaos and confusion of the home. I'm the oldest of four, so I grew up as a protector and a defender of my three little brothers. So I still have that kind of mechanism in me. And so spent a big part of my childhood and teenage and adult years just fighting through a poverty mindset and the victim mentality and the insecurity of no identity, all the things that come along with that, and fighting off the generational patterns of addiction, et cetera. So that's kind of my childhood and how I grew up.
Wow. Rough childhood. Statistically, you shouldn't be talking to me honestly right now because of that start.
Yeah.
You know, kids who go through that typically, unfortunately, that, you know, don't find their way out of it. And so as you're going through this, HR, and you're watching the family kind of crumble around you, and you're hearing things that you had no idea about, and watching people that you cared about pass away, things like that. How did you cope with it yourself? Like, other than just trying to fit in, or, you know, what did you do?
Yeah. So my early coping mechanisms are things that you would expect. I didn't want to go the route of drugs and alcohol and cigarettes that my parents were. And, and like you said, my younger brothers all went that route. Two of my younger brothers are dead and all went down drugs and alcoholism, heavy drug use. One became a pedophile, child molester. So yeah, I'm the only one of the four that escaped. So early on, I knew I didn't want that. So my early mechanisms were sports, the outdoors. I spent as much time out of the house as I could. I became an avid backpacker and outdoorsman. I love sports. Yeah. So those are my early kind of retreats and escapes. When I began to mature a little bit, I could process things. I realized that I had to change my mindset and how I thought about things and how I thought about myself and how I thought about the future and what I was going to do with all this pain that was handed to me. I could go the victim route and continue those generational patterns, or I could take ownership of my thinking and by doing so, take ownership of my future. But that came in my late teens and early 20s is when I began realizing I just needed to think differently than the thought behavior patterns that I was handed.
Wow. You know, I hear that a lot. People find some solace when they go backpacking, hiking, get into the mountains.
Yeah.
Talk about that experience a little bit, because I think a lot of people listening to you right now, like, you know what? Hey, that's something I do. Why did that mean so much to you?
I don't know that I could actually answer the why, Todd, to be honest with you. I think early on, it was just a get out of the house mechanism. So this is Southern New Mexico. So in my childhood years, it was the desert, the high desert around Alamogordo and my dog Scamp. And that became an escape for me. Yeah. Just my dog and myself out in the desert, just killing rattlesnakes and finding rocks. And so I think it became an escape mechanism early on, but as it developed, it just became a part of my soul. I live on 40 acres now. I have dogs, avid backpacker. For me, it's a healing place. It's a place where my soul connects. I'm a person of faith, so my soul connects with God out there. And it's a refuge for me. And it's just a huge part of my identity. I've put hundreds and hundreds of nights under the stars and thousands of miles on trails. And it's a great healing place for me.
Wow, I love that. Thanks for sharing that. Do you mind talking a little bit more about, you know, you don't have to go all the details, but just why is your faith so important to you? And how did you kind of find that going, you know, growing up in the circumstances you did?
Yeah. So I grew up in pretty much a atheistic home. God or any kind of faith was no part of anything that we talked about. And I'm pretty science minded. I absolutely love science and logic and reason to this day. My first book is this journey from atheism and reason and science to, in my opinion, how much of science points to intelligent design and a creator. So for me, the faith journey came through thinking. I can remember, Todd, as clearly as I'm talking to you right now, I'm sitting in 10th grade chemistry class, and I'm looking at the periodic chart of the elements, and I'm looking up at it like, that seems pretty well organized. Like,
yeah.
It was impressive to me. I'm looking at it thinking, how do all these connect, and they make elements, and or they make compounds, and it seems pretty well designed. And that literally began a journey of discovery. From there, I went to biology class and I learned how DNA works. I mean, DNA is simply information. Yeah. It's a computer code that directs all the protein development of our entire body. And I thought, where does information come from? Like a computer code. There must be a coder back there someplace.
Right.
So this idea, this curiosity of a coder and a designer and a creator led me to just really explore, like, how did this all come to be and come to pass? And so it's my curiosity, which is a huge part of how I'm made and what I do, led me just to ask hard questions about how things came to be, which led me to a very profound personal faith that is the foundation of everything that I do, really.
I love that. And that makes a lot of sense when you say it that way. It's like, man, how did this all come together? I kind of do the same thing when I think of our solar system how it just perfectly works. And it's like, how did that happen?
It's amazing.
So I kind of had the same experience, if you will, just a little differently, but I agree with you.
Yeah. How can something come from nothing? How can intelligence come from accident? Like, those are really good, hard questions. And like I said, that's not to pitch my book, but those questions are the foundation of my first book, answering some of those questions.
No, I love that. Yeah. And I did fail to mention in the beginning, you are a published author. You've got some books and, you know, again, you're making a really huge impact in this world. Before we get into all the great things you're doing, I want to talk about a few other things. Like,
sure.
So you grow up in this tough environment. You find some solace getting out of the house and going into the mountains. You start attaching yourself and connecting with your faith and a higher power. And, you know, how did you transition from, man, this struggle to where now you're helping people who struggle?
Yeah.
You know, how did you do that?
Right. I mean, that's obviously going to come with the faith component. So I left my house as a computer programmer. I wanted to be a software designer, engineer. This is in the early 80s. This little company called Microsoft had just started, and I was a pretty good computer programmer at the time. I already had two copyrighted software programs before I left high school, and I knew this was going to be my future. I was going to be a multi-bazillionaire, and I could tell kind of where all this stuff was going. So money was going to be the way that I covered all my insecurities and all the imposter syndrome of growing up poor and trailer trash and white trash and all the stuff I heard. And what I decided early on is I'm going through school, working on all my engineering degrees or classes, I should say. And I decided I don't think that's how I want to use this pain. I want to use my experience and I want to transfer it and I want to maximize it. I want to leverage it and I want to make a difference. So I decided to use my scars and my experience and my pain differently at that point. Mm. And it wasn't going to be to make money. It was going to be to make impact. So
wow,
I wanted to make the world a better place. And that led me to starting my first company.
Wow. Well, you created Leader's Edge, correct?
My first company, Leader's Edge, is my retirement company.
Okay.
Is what I'm doing in my second half of my career. My first company was a nonprofit. I started at 28 when I knew everything at 28. And we started that from scratch, and it was designed as a nonprofit humanitarian organization. We were going to make a difference in the world. And we built it from scratch to very large. When I retired at age 50, we had 200 staff in 5 countries around the world doing all kinds of great projects, water projects, hygiene projects. We were helping build orphanages and rehab centers and a counseling center. We followed hurricanes, Katrina and Ike, and helped rebuild New Orleans and Galveston, food programs here in the local area. We worked with jails and worked with the Maasai tribe in Kenya. Anyway, so that's what I did from 28 to 50.
Wow. Yeah, amazing stuff there. And obviously, while you're doing this, we mentioned, you know, I in my research, man, you've done some amazing things outside of just your career. One in particular I'd like you to talk about is, you know, you love climbing mountains. And you had an experience on Mount Rainier where you were stuck in a tent for 36 hours. Were you doing this as you're building this company? Like, how did you get into, like, man, I'm going to go climb Mount Rainier? Because that is no easy weekend task, you know?
No. Rainier is the most glaciated peak in the lower 48. It's a tough mountain.
Yeah.
I climbed it eight times, by the way. the time. So you're going to pick up on a little bit of my personality. I try to live big. My early years, I was around a lot of death, dad, brothers, a lot of family members. And that planted in me a seed just to enjoy life to its fullest. As you mentioned in your opener, one of my taglines is life is a gift. I want to unwrap it every day. Mm. So I like to explore and enjoy life. So we have Mount Rainier right here in our backyard. It's like, why wouldn't I climb it? I'm not just going to climb it, Todd. I'm going to climb it 8 times. I'm not just going to climb it 8 times. I'm going to become a guide. And I've led about 56 people up Mount Rainier. And it's just kind of the way I do things. It's a bit of a obsession. And praise God, I'm married to a wife who's like, you go climb, you go jump off stuff, you go be a maniac. I'll be here baking cookies. So the climb you're referring to is my very first climb. And we're just getting up on the Muir snowfield, just heading to Camp Muir, which is the base camp. And a lightning storm hits, which leads to a severe whiteout and snowstorm. And like you said, 36 hours trapped in this tent. I remember leaving the tent one time, Todd, and I was just going to go to the bathroom. So I just go out and go to the bathroom real fast and turn around. I can't see anything. I mean, I actually, 30 feet from my tent, I actually got lost. It probably took me 10 or 15 minutes to find.
Wow.
The tent scared the crap out of me.
Yeah.
Because people die on Mount Rainier just about every year. So anyway, that began my Mount Rainier climbing journey.
I can't imagine being stuck in a tent. I mean, to put it in perspective, I think about 36 hours. Yeah. That is a long time.
Man, you get so bored. I wasn't smart enough to bring cards or a book or I want to keep my pack as light as possible. So I'm just literally laying there for 36 hours waiting for the storm to pass. It was monumentally boring.
Oh man. I love it though. So, and that was your first time hiking it.
That was my first time.
Which is amazing that you wanted to do it again and again and again after that.
But it was the hardest thing I ever did. I climbed this, and I thought I was in pretty good shape. I was in my, probably early 30s or mid 30s by this time. Yeah. I was in good shape. I was a triathlete and CrossFit dude, and I was in good shape. And I climbed, and it's like, oh, there's a difference between gym shape and mountaineer shape. Like, those are not this. And I told my wife, I came down and said, I'm never doing that thing again. That's the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And I ended up doing 7 more times. So,
yeah, I think you said, if you want to get ready for that, you got to do 1 million squats, 1 million deadlifts, and it's still going to suck.
That's right. It is. Yeah. And so my wife says, why do you do it again? I don't know. Don't ask me hard questions.
I love it. Well, you mentioned something a little earlier I want to talk about, because a lot of my clients that I deal with, HR, struggle with this, and it's the imposter syndrome.
Oh, goodness.
You brought that up, and I think this would be a good thing to talk about. I want to hear your thoughts on it, and you obviously struggled with it. How does someone get through that? And just talk a little bit about that for those who may not know much about it.
So I didn't struggled with it past tense. I still wrestle with this, Todd.
Mm, okay.
I still, now to a lesser degree, I have a greater, understanding of my identity and my worth and my impact on the world, but there's probably not a quarter that goes by that I don't face the, I don't know if I'm enough for this next phase question. Certainly with my background in childhood, it's, deeply entrenched in you. You grow up poor and the kind of family I grew up in. So you're always comparing yourself to others. And I never measured up athletically, physically, financially. Family was a mess. So I now work with business owners around the country. And I can tell you, every CEO in every boardroom and every entrepreneur and every business owner wrestles with this. So to your listeners listening, you are not alone. We all wrestle with this. I think one of the things that we think we're the only ones that deal with this, and we don't want to share it because we feel ashamed or embarrassed or whatever. Listen, everybody, we all deal with this. So to your question, how do you work through it? One, surround yourself with people where you can have this conversation.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid to say, sometimes I feel like I'm not enough. I think that's the statement that the imposter syndrome makes is, I'm not enough for this particular thing, to be this kind of husband or leader or provider, whatever it is. And then I think facing it and saying it out loud is step number one. Surround yourself with really good people. You can have these good, healthy, vulnerable conversations. And then get about rolling up your sleeves and educating yourself, honing a skill, moving in the direction of your weakness. You can't sit. Yeah. If you just sit there and wallow in that insecurity or the imposter syndrome, you know, you're not going anyplace. So roll up your sleeves and walk in the direction of that fear or insecurity or whatever it is.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, there's a lot of power in talking about it because then we can connect. And like you said, you know, I think a lot of times those people who are struggling with it, and I've struggled with it too, and I'm sure. I'm with you. I mean, I've done, you know, thousands of speaking events as well. And every time before I walk out on that stage, I'm back there wrestling with this voice saying, dude, who are you?
Right.
You know, who are you to go out there and talk to these people?
That's right. We all do, right? We all wrestle with that.
Yeah.
The person who says they don't wrestle with this, I think A, is a liar, or B, they're a sociopath. One of the two. I'm not...
Right. Yeah. But I think I'm glad you said it that way too, HR. And I appreciate the humility around it because I think, you know, like when I watch you on stage, I mean, you command a very powerful presence. You've got a very stern voice. You hold your head high. No one would ever guess this dude struggles with thinking that he doesn't belong here.
Right.
So I'm glad that you're being honest about it because I think someone might look at you and go, man, I wish I can't do what he does because, man, you know, I'm nothing like that guy. But
sure.
But when knowing that maybe you struggle, that might help them realize they're not alone.
Yeah, I just realized to all of your listeners, I was not like that guy either. I mean, I only became that guy, this guy, simply because I worked hard on honing my craft.
Yeah.
So one thing I want to get across is you can't just wallow in that imposter syndrome mindset. You can't just sit there. And let me go back on one of the things I said. You can't just gather people around you that are going to embrace your pity or I don't celebrate that at all. Have people around you that are going to champion you forward, not just say, poor you. Roll up your sleeves, head in the direction of your fear, work on those things. And then what happens, Todd, and you know this, is that every level gets a little easier.
Yeah.
So in the early days, speaking to 50 people would scare the crap out of me. Right. Well, speaking to 50 people now is like, you know, that's, you know, it's nothing. And then speaking to 100 people scare the crap, and then 500 and 1,000. And I was invited to speak in Kampala, Uganda, 65,000 people. I'm like, oh, holy crap. Wow. I don't know about. So each level has its own challenges and you just move in the direction of that fear.
Wow. I love that. Thanks for sharing that. Another question I have for you, I want to talk about these three things. And I see it in my own, with my own clients, how important this is. And we're going to talk, it's authenticity, vulnerability, and humility. You actually call that superpowers for a leader.
Absolutely.
Talk about that and share with us your insights on that.
Sure. In fact, to reinforce this belief, a study just came out 2 weeks ago that I read where they polled followers of, in the poll's eyes, the 200 most influential leaders around the world from all ethnicities and backgrounds and blah, 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 blah. And they asked, what is the most important trait of this leader that you believe in and respect? And authenticity was the number one trait, 2-1 over the second thing.
Wow.
And they talked about how much respect is garnered when leaders are real and they're vulnerable. And they kind of put authenticity and vulnerability together.
Yeah.
We separate them out a little bit, but I think that's just splitting hairs.
Yeah.
We as humans do not respect people who live in a superficial armor because we can see that that's not real. People who lead from places of insincerity or inauthenticity, or we know that they're hiding something. We can see that. So we don't respect as much. Our respect level is lower. And the interesting about being those leaders is, and this is the way that I believe leadership was, we were supposed to have the answers. As a leader, you're supposed to know what to do at all times.
Yeah.
And that's how I led in my early years, my late 20s and early 30s. And I came to realize that's a fraudulent version of leadership.
Oh, okay.
It is fraudulent and it is not as impactful.
Yeah.
And when I began to allow myself to remove my armor, and that's what it is, remove our armor and get real, I found that I had a much greater connectivity, which allowed me much greater impact. To everyone listening, removing that armor, it's a scary deal because we feel like that armor is protective, right? It's that, it's that superficial protective mechanism. I'm not gonna let them see the real me, because if they see the real me, they won't really like me.
Mm.
It's connected to that imposter syndrome. If they see the real me, they're gonna reject me, when in fact we accept and embrace authenticity more, but it's our shame that keeps that armor on.
Yeah.
And Brené Brown has done a great job of helping us understand, work through that shame, disrobe that armor, let people see a little bit more authentic you, and you have a much greater opportunity to lead people and impact people.
Yeah, I love that. And I, you know, in my business, when I'm working with drug addicts and alcoholics who are struggling, and we're doing like group therapy,
sure,
the ones that will get vulnerable and real and authentic of what their struggles are, and they open up to the group, as hard as that is in the moment, when they'll say 100% of the time afterwards, man, I've never felt more connected with that group. And the people who heard it say the same thing about that person.
Absolutely right.
It's a beautiful thing. So obviously it would make sense. It would be the same in leadership.
Yeah, it's exactly the same in leadership. Like, one of the things that I do when I run leadership groups or cohorts, or we have a program called Leaders at University, and these emerging young leaders, I make them get up and tell their story and their vision and their mission and what they want to accomplish. And sometimes they'll tell their story and they'll say things like, I've never shared this before, this pain, this hurt, this whatever. And then I'll ask the class, do you respect this person less or more? And you know, it's always more.
Right.
It's always more. And what's interesting is we think they'll respect us less if they see our weakness, when in fact, the opposite is true. We're respected more when we're authentic. But you're right. It's an act of courage. It takes guts.
Yeah, I love that. Thanks for clarifying that. That's beautiful. You know, I know you learned some principles while climbing mountains that you share to your leaders that you're training and coaching. And do you mind sharing some of those principles that you learned by climbing mountains?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of my favorites is this one. Climb with the summit in mind.
Mm.
I've given this talk a lot. When you're climbing Kilimanjaro, Mount Rainier, there are sometimes all I can think about is putting my left foot in front of my right foot. Like, that's all I care about in that moment. Like, this is so freaking hard. Why am I doing this again? I can't remember.
Yeah, right.
And if you don't have the summit in mind, you're going to give up and turn around and go home. If the only thing I have in mind is my left foot in front of my right, there's not enough motivation or inspiration there.
Yeah.
So, and what that means in a practical setting is, I'll pretend I'm talking to you, Todd. What's the summit of your life? Like, what's your meaning? What's your purpose? What's your big why? What's your vision for your life? Is it your family? To live a certain way when you retire? What kind of impact do you want to make? Like, give voice to that. Write that down. And that becomes the summit you're shooting for. So then each week in business, or each quarter and where cash flow is low, or someone quit or got a bad Google review, it's like, okay, keep that summit in mind.
Wow,
keep that summit in mind. Pick your head up. I'll lift their chin up. It's like, okay, let's remember what we're climbing for. That's one of my favorite leadership principles, is climb with the summit in mind. Another one that I like to, you know, I'll just go with these two, is know who you're roped up to.
Mm,
you know, you climb a glaciated mountain, you climb Mount Rainier or Everest or whatever, you're on a rope team. And that rope team is really important, because if you fall, they have to catch you. And if they fall, you've got to catch them. And you want to be around people that are climbing at your pace and your direction, that are going to champion you. So there's another good principle there. Who's on your team? Who's in your ear? Who's championing your climb? Make sure those people have your back. They know how to pick you up when you fall down, and you're headed in the same direction. So know who your rope team is.
Well, I love that. So if you don't mind me asking you, what is your why? Like, what is your summit in life that you're keeping in mind all the time?
Yeah. So my personal vision statement I've written on my wall in my office is I dedicate my life to helping other people come fully alive. Mm. Obviously, this comes out of my childhood, out of my background.
Yeah.
And so I think in three concentric circles, and I want to make an impact. I want to leave the world a better place. I want to use my pain for good. And that begins, the first concentric circle is my family. I want to make sure that my kids catch me in the act of excellence.
Ooh, I love that.
I want to make sure my kids know that where you come from doesn't matter. Everyone can make a difference. Yeah. And Huntsman's, we our passion is to make a difference, to make an impact. So I want my kids to catch me in the act of excellence so they can learn that they can live a life that is impactful. That's concentric circle number one.
Wow.
Concentric circle number two are all the leaders that I get to impact. I focus on leaders because leaders are multipliers. If yeah. I impact one business leader, I impact their entire team and their families. And so that's concentric circle number two. I change the world one leader at a time. And then concentric circle number three, all the people that I'm privileged to speak on stage to. JFK said a quote one time that I take to heart: every time you get on stage, you should try to change the world.
Wow.
So my summit is I want to change the world with my kids, leaders, and every time I get to use words to impact a room, I want to move a room.
Wow. I love that. You know, it reminded me what you said there of Stephen Covey, who wrote the book, you know, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People.
Sure.
His why is he wants to unleash human potential.
Yeah.
And I think that's exactly what you're saying. And yeah. Boy, that is really inspiring. Man, I got goosebumps when you're telling me what your why is. And I think how important it is to not only maybe say it in your mind, but have it written down so you can see it. So it's a part of your yeah. life, right?
Right. Yeah, it's right to the left of my workstation in my office. I see it every day. Just a reminder. Because life can punch you in the face sometimes. I mean, it can yeah. sucker punch you. We all face tough stuff, and to climb with my summit in mind reminds me, I'm gonna make sure my kids, and now I have two grandsons. I want them to catch me in the act of excellence because I want them to know their life matters, and they can change the world.
Wow, I love it, and I love you get emotional talking about it because obviously yeah. that means so much to you. Thanks, it does. HR. That's powerful.
Thanks, brother.
This is why I love doing these podcasts, to be able to connect with you like this. I mean, you're tearing me up, and I love it. I love it because this is the vulnerability piece you're talking about, right. You know, as well. So,
yeah, what I do means a lot to me. I'm passionate about it.
Yeah. Well, why don't we talk about that for a second? What do you do for our leaders who don't know maybe what the Leader's Edge is and what that's all about? And what are you trying to do, you know, besides change the world?
Right.
Give us a little more specifics.
Sure. So from my first company, my first organization, all those great projects I told you about, what happened along the way was, so I was not expecting this, Todd, is the projects became less of a focus to me as the building of the teams to do the projects. I quickly realized if I was going to scale this to anything that really made a difference around the world, I had to build teams and leaders. Well, I didn't have any training for that. I mean, obviously, you know, there's no leadership. There's nothing. So I set myself on a course to become a better leader, to learn how to build teams, to improve myself as a communicator, vision caster, problem solver, et cetera. And so I really dedicated myself to team building, organizational strategy, organizational psychology, made lots of mistakes. I think I teach more from my mistakes than I teach from my successes.
Right.
So when I retired at 50, I can't retire. I love investing in people. So I had some options of what I want to do. I could teach or open another counseling center. And no, I want to invest in leaders. So I started Leader's Edge. And every day we focus on honing and sharpening the skills of leaders, entrepreneurs, executives, business owners, and building the teams around them The average American worker spends over 90,000 waking hours at work. Mm, and so wow. I coined this phrase destination workplace. I try to help leaders build places of meaningfulness and purpose where people aren't just there to get a paycheck and, you know, they're robots or zombies making widgets, but they like who they work with. They like who they work around. They believe in what they do. They're great contributors. These teams are collaborative and powerful, and there's good creative conflict, and there's dynamic meetings, and all the things that make up amazing organizations. We try to help build those everywhere we go.
Wow. I love that. And, you know, I know that, again, you love helping people and making a difference. Do you see yourself like growing this in a different way, or is there another big project on the horizon for you that you're thinking about, you know, another thing that you want to I want to accomplish this as well?
So the short answer is no.
Okay.
Leader's Edge is already far bigger than because I led this very large organization, large to me anyway, 200 staff, and I said, I just want Leader's Edge to be this nice niche thing. I just want to spend 20 or 30 hours a week investing in hand-selected leaders, and it's already busted way past that. And we have a good team of associate coaches, and organizations are contacting us on a regular basis. Can you help us with this and that? So the short answer is no, there's no other big project.
Okay.
In my mind right now, Leader's Edge is –
yeah,
how I ride into the sunset. I'm going to develop these wonderful young leaders, including my son, and hand the reins over to him. And
nice.
My son works with me. We want to hand it off to his sons, David and Matthew, who are all of 2 and 7 months old right now. But so that's the big project, is really building Leader's Edge to be a legacy organization to impact the world through leadership.
Love it. Beautiful. You know, what is someone like such as yourself, who's very passionate, who at times wrestles with imposter syndrome, who has a family that he loves so much, loves making an impact. What does someone do like on a daily basis? Like, what are your habits? Like, do you have like a routine you follow in the morning kind of thing? Would you share a little bit about what your day looks like?
Yeah, and you're right. Some of these good disciplines are really important. I would love to say, and I'm a fairly high achiever. I think every high achiever says it's never enough. Like, we always want to be better. Yeah. So get up first thing is my thinking time. I spend a good hour in the morning just thinking. I talk about my thinking chair. I stole that from John Maxwell early in my leadership years, of just spending time thinking in silence alone, either with a notepad or just yourself. So this is where a lot of my best ideas have come from. Leaders at University, A Performance Engine, both of my books have come from just this quiet time of just thinking.
Yeah.
So I start off with a thinking time before I do anything. And then I'll go to the computer, and I'll always get on emails or recaps that I need to write. And then throughout the day, I'll have my coaching sessions or workshops that I speak at. And then at night, I come home and spend time with my family. My wife and I eat dinner together every single night. We have family night every week on Thursday nights.
Oh, nice. The
kids and grandkids come over. That's highly important to us. Just about every day, it's important to me to walk the trails. We've created an adventure course here on our property. We have a lot of our corporate clients come and do this adventure deal. So it's important to me just to get out there with my dogs. I'm still, Todd, I'm still a 9-year-old kid with dogs, if I'm going to be honest. I'm still a 9-year-old boy who wants to be with my dogs in the woods. So
I love it.
Every day I'm out there. So, there's nothing, you know, rocket science about this. Is read, think. Yeah. Work, be diligent and disciplined, and follow up and communicate with people, and have one eye on what you're doing today and one eye on what you're doing 10 years from now.
Wow. Love it. That's amazing. I think that's important to know where you're going. I know for me personally, having a morning routine really helps me start the day. I call it my morning meds. it helps me get going, but I love that. You know, If there's someone listening to your voice right now, HR, they're in a really bad place. They're in a dark place. They're struggling. You've already shared some amazing things already, but what could you tell that one person right now who's in that place? What would you say to them?
Sure. Number one, you're not alone. You're not alone. Don't think you are. I think that's the biggest lie of people who struggle with addiction or depression, or you're not alone. Number two, rope yourself up to someone who can help you climb out of this crevasse.
Mm.
Rope yourself up to someone who can help you climb out of this crevasse. I taught crevasse rescue classes, and there's some important steps. So find someone, a therapist, a counselor, a coach, a friend. When you stay alone, you stay stuck.
Yeah.
So rope yourself up to someone who can help you climb out of that crevasse, and then just put one step in front of the other.
Wow. Beautifully said. Thank you for sharing that. You know, for those listening that want to learn more about UHR and they want to maybe connect and get involved with your leadership company, what's the best way, and also get, you know, purchase your books and things like that. What's the best way for them to do that?
Sure. Yeah, listeners of Todd's, if you're working with a company that is either plateaued or you want to scale or grow, absolutely reach out to me, hr@yourleadersedge.com, hr@yourleadersedge.com. You can find me on LinkedIn. Our website is yourleadersedge.com. Email me. Let's connect and see if I can add value to your journey and what you're building there.
I love it. And I'll put those links in the show notes when we go live, so they'll be able to easily click and get to you.
Perfect.
And I do recommend anyone who's, you know, looking to, you know, like you said, you know, improve where they're at and or if you're stuck, to get unstuck,
yeah,
to definitely reach out to you and tap into all the great that you're doing, HR. And I can't thank you enough for taking some time today. It's been a beautiful conversation. You're easy to talk to, and I can feel your passion and your vulnerability. It's been amazing.
Well, thank you, my friend. Thanks for reaching out. Thanks for inviting me. And I just applaud you. I mean, what you're doing is powerful. It's life-changing. Not only this podcast, but all your speaking events. You're changing lives. I champion you.
Thank you.
Any of your listeners that need to reach out to you, they should. I know you're helping a lot of people. You should be really proud of what you're doing.
Well, that means a lot, HR. Thank you. So glad to connect with you, my friend.
Thank you.
There you go, folks. I told you today you're in for a treat. HR Huntsman, man, please check him out. If you know anyone who is struggling even and just needs to hear some words that will uplift them, I mean, HR has been through it. He's been through hell and back, and here he is, you know, making a difference in this world, and he's proof that we all can do this. And so send him a link to this episode. Please subscribe and like, and you know, I can't thank you enough for all your support. It means the world. And I really believe that these episodes, and this one today especially, is going to save someone's life. I really do believe that. I know that's a bold thing to say, but I really do believe that. Thank you for tuning in. Love you, and until next time. Again, HR, thanks for all you do, brother.
Thank you, my friend.